Saturdays, 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. starting next Saturday, March 22nd. And Deborah, guess what?
What?
We're going to still continue to play the best old school music of all time. So we just want you to be there. 89.3.
Hello, I'm David Whetstone, and you're listening to member-supported WPFW Washington.
And welcome to Community Watching Comment for Tuesday, March 25th. I'm Dave Raymond. It's, as always, great to be with you. Later in the show, we're going to have a couple of directors from the D.C. Environmental Film Festival, very important festival, talking about our environment, which you're not hearing enough about because it's drowned out by all the other noise going on out of our nation's capital, but very important. But first, on one level, it's not surprising that there are enormous child poverty disparities when looking at race, place, and age in D.C. D.C. child poverty was disproportionately felt, is disproportionately felt by Black children, older children, and those living east of the river. It's completely unacceptable, but it becomes particularly unacceptable when you hear, put another way, and let's say it right now, nearly one in three Black children in D.C. live in poverty, compared to just one in 100 white non-Hispanic children. Let's say that again, nearly one in three, 33% of Black children in D.C. live in poverty, compared to just 1 in 100 white non-Hispanic children. I mean, it's rather daunting and extraordinary. And joining us to cut through the numbers is Kona Zielinski, a data associate at the D.C. Fiscal Policy Institute, where we had them on last week, and we had them on this week. They're doing extraordinary work. Connor, welcome to a Community Watch and Comment. It's great to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we welcome callers. Please chime in. This is Community Watch and Comment. We want to hear from you. 202-588-0893. At 202-588-0893, and speak with Connor for a bit, and then we would really appreciate your input, particularly if you're east from the river. 202-588-0893. You know, talking numbers can be a bit numbing. It's been said that, and this is Joseph Stalin, maybe the only a positive thing that he contributed to the zeitgeist. The death of one man is a tragedy. The death of millions is a statistic. You probably heard that, Connor, but I think it applies. We're looking at data here. We're looking at statistics, which is incredibly important. But your thoughts, nearly one in three Black children in D.C. live in poverty, compared to just one in 100 white non-Hispanic children. It's unnerving.
Exactly. And as you mentioned earlier, child poverty is closely linked to race, place, and age due to historic systemic inequities. In fact, over the past 2 years, we've seen that child poverty in D.C. remain stagnant at 17.1%. From 2022 to 2023, and is disproportionately felt by Black children, older children, and those living east of the river.
Yeah, I mean, it's daunting, you know, and we, you know, people on this side of the river, I guess west of the river, you could say, you know, you don't realize it, but this is extraordinary divergence on this side of the Anacostia River which is east of the river.
Yes, and the gap is actually very significant. DC children in Ward 7 and 8 are predominantly Black, and experience child poverty rate at 30% on average from 2019 to 2023. The statistics are unreliable for all the other wards in DC, but based on the demographic information that you provided earlier, it would be reasonable to assume that wards two, for example, wards 2 and 3 have a lower child poverty rate.
Right, and let's talk about the long-term impact of the poverty rates. For example, children experience poverty tend to be worse off in a range of ways. Poor kids begin school well behind their affluent peers, if you could talk about that.
Yeah, so like you just mentioned, children experiencing poverty tend to enter school behind their peers, score lower on achievement tests, work less and earn less as adults, and often have worse health outcomes. This pattern is especially clear for the poorest and youngest children who remain in poverty during childhood. There is even greater harm when children growing up poor are also in high poverty areas where the cumulative harm of hardship is magnified.
I mean, it's a long-term kind of thing. There's all kinds of data. We're talking about weaker reading and math skills, less well-behaved. I mean, we're not talking about just an immediate effect. We're talking about long-term effects here.
Exactly. And DC must do more to reduce child poverty to avoid more of those long-term impacts, especially at a time when federal lawmakers are poised to make deep cuts into the critical income supports for families that are struggling to meet ends meet.
And there's a whole element that I hadn't quite realized. There's even greater harm when children growing up poor are also living in high poverty areas where the cumulative harm of hardship is magnified. If you could talk about that.
Yeah, so the issues around child poverty tend to exacerbate themselves. So a child living in an area with high rates of poverty tends to all of those effects of living in child poverty that you're talking about earlier, those are exacerbated when you're in an environment that's been historically poor for a very significant long period of time.
And we'd love to hear from folks listening to this broadcast, 202-588-0893. That's 202-588-0893. We want to hear from listeners. This is an incredibly important topic, and we need for you to chime in. 202-588-0893. And so we're talking about 17% increased poverty rate amongst children of color in the district, but east of the river, we're talking about a 30% differential in the poverty rate. If you could talk about that, my dear esteemed guest.
So the overall child poverty rate in the district is 17.1%. But when we look closer at that statistic, we realize that there's intense disparities between race, place, and age. For what you just mentioned, nearly 30% of children living in Ward 7 and 8 are living in poverty. As we talked about earlier, nearly 1 in 3 Black children in DC lived in poverty from 2019 to 2023, based on U.S. Census Bureau data. And that's compared to just 1 in 100 white non-Hispanic children in the district. Moreover, child poverty also varies drastically by age in DC. Older children are more likely to live under the poverty line than younger children. Typically at the national level, younger children experience poverty at a higher rate compared to older children, in part because caregivers tend to earn less income when their children are younger, and this bucks the trend in DC. Compared to other states, the district is tied for fifth in the highest child poverty rate from children ages 6 to 17.
I mean, it's rather daunting. You know, I often am saying to friends, you know, I have numerous friends who are being let off because of all the cut to federal workers in the district. But, you know, it's all relative. You know, we're not in Gaza, we're not in Sudan. But right here in the district, I mean, there's this incredible disparity between west of the Anacostia River and east of the Anacostia River. Children in DC are more likely to live in poverty than children ages 0 through 6, which, as you said, why we're bucking the trend between children older than 6 years old and those 0 to 6 years old.
Yeah, so DC's public investment in early learning opportunities for young children, like universal pre-K, have shown to improve the later labor force participation of DC parents, and maybe the reason why DC's young child poverty rate isn't as high. There's also supports out there, like the recently passed child tax credit, which DC FPI hopes lawmakers will expand in the future.
Yeah, I mean, it's rather daunting. So we want to hear from callers. Please chime in, particularly if you're east of the river, 202-588-0893. We need you to chime in. This is a community watch and comment. We need your watch and your comment. So please chime in. What do you suggest that people advocate for in terms of differing this equation? And we live in difficult times, needless to say. What do you suggest that that people advocate for in terms of changing the numbers on this equation?
Yeah, so at DC FPI, we envision a future where every DC child has everything they need to live to their fullest, and therefore DC should do more to reduce child poverty, like as you said, especially as the federal system becomes more and more upended. And we already have some supports in the district, like the DC's Child Tax Credit, or CTC, but that's limited to children below the age of 6. And we would like to see an expansion of that to all children under the age of 18. Furthermore, getting cash and economic supports to families that have that live below the poverty line can make a lasting difference in the child's lives and how they fare as adults. Families will be able to put food on the table and buy other necessities that are integral for a growing child.
Right. So we're talking about, I mean, part of the reason that we're bucking the numbers here in DC is that we already have universal pre-kindergarten classrooms. If you could talk about what you are advocating at the DC Fiscal Policy Institute in terms of reform in that regard.
Mm-hmm. So as you said, DC has made large investments in families with children through child care subsidy program, universal pre-K, cash pilots for single mothers, local food day, and DC's own earned income tax credit and child tax credit. among many other targeted supports. We would like to see an expansion of those programs to be more inclusive, and so that way it can further support struggling families who have children.
I mean, it's, you know, these are all kinds of numbers, as and numbers, as I said earlier, can be numbing. What are we talking about when we're talking about DC's earned income tax credit? If you could talk about that, and then let's talk about the child tax credit.
Yeah, so DC's earned income tax credit would provide tax relief coming around around tax season, which is coincidentally right now.
We are in it.
Yes. And it would provide relief to families through a cash assistance. And if that were to be expanded, that would be really beneficial for a lot of families, especially those east of the river.
And talk about what DC has a particular child tax credit, if you could talk about that.
Yeah, so DC passed the child tax credit, or CTC, very recently, a couple years ago, and it has made a huge impact on families that are eligible for the program. And that would be for children under the age of 6, and I believe it is limited to 3 children per family. DC FPI recognizes that this program should be expanded. As mentioned earlier, we've been bucking the national trend. Typically, older children are less likely to be poverty. That trend is reversed in DC. We know the benefits of a child tax credit are immense, and therefore we should look to expand that child tax credit for all children under the age of 18.
I mean, these are numbers, but it's terribly important that people understand that we're talking about our children here, the most vulnerable. They can't vote. They're not involved in the political zeitgeist, if you will. And it's terribly important. We'd love to hear from callers, not hearing from you. Come on, folks, 202-588-0893. Please chime in, particularly if you're experiencing the drought of public assistance here in the district. It's important, I think, that we're talking to you, Connor, from the D.C. Fiscal Policy Institute. We're talking about the district being faced with a billion-dollar cut in our own finances, not federal funding, but our own tax finances here in the district. In your understanding, what would that mean in terms of support for underserved children in the district?
Yes, so that $1.1 billion that we would lose of our own tax money that's already been paid, that's going to teachers and cops and amongst various other programs, that impact would be devastating, especially because so many families rely on the supports for their children from the district government. So therefore, DC FPI would like lawmakers to potentially raise revenue by taxing wealth directly, and that way to absorb some of the cuts. And that way we can expand upon those programs and make sure that they're maintained in the first place.
I mean, it's rather daunting. I mean, it's extraordinary. We're not talking about a cutoff by the federal government, by Congress and the president, of funds distributed to D.C. We're talking about money that has been raised from taxes from D.C. Taxpayers to our budget. I mean, it's rather extraordinary. And we're talking today, I mean, it's going to be decided this week whether or not the Trump administration is going to be able to cut those funds.
And exactly. And we're looking to avoid those cuts as much as possible. But if lawmakers do decide to raise revenue, Raising a dollar is a dollar they don't have to cut in the future. And it would be very, and it maintain the programs that so many people rely on. And yes, that CR is extremely daunting and extremely worrying, especially for those who rely on all those services.
So I'm wondering, what is your evaluation of what's likely to happen? This is an important week. I mean, an important day, arguably. What do you think is likely to happen in terms of our ability as a district, as essentially a state, to be able to use our own monies to support the people in the district?
I'm not super familiar with what, or I wouldn't be able to make any guarantees as to what would happen. All I know that these cuts would be devastating, and lawmakers in Congress should avoid meddling in DC's budget at all costs.
Yeah, I mean, it's rather daunting. We're going to take a music break. We're not hearing from callers. Please chime in. Oh, we've got a caller. Fantastic. I appreciate you calling in. Your name, we're calling from, if you're so inclined, and your question or your comment. I appreciate your calling.
Hi, yes. Thank you for the research coming out of the BC Fiscal Policy Institute. My name is Gloria Nodden, and I run a grassroots nonprofit in Ward 8 called the DC Community Development Consortium Institute. So we do some grassroots research, and then we're responsive to the community through participatory grant making. So we focus on funding Black businesses in Ward 8. So today we call it place-based grant making. So our theory of change, I couldn't help but call in because, you know, the opposite of poverty is having money. And when you have disinvested in communities like Ward 8, but you have west of the river that is thoroughly invested in, you see the stark difference, where there is zero white children in Washington, D.C. that are in poverty or homeless. So to hear the statistics are absolutely always alarming and numbing, unfortunately, at the same time. But if we can try to be innovative here in the most powerful city in the world and stare these statistics that are achievable, when we say 30%, I think we're talking about, I don't know, 5,600 children maybe in Ward 8. I mean, these are numbers that are achievable, and our theory of change is around fund Black businesses. You know, there are businesses that are capable of providing the employment that then, you know, trickles down to livable wages and the dignity of even working to provide for your family. So if we can start thinking more around systemic solutions to these chronically systemic issues, and banking and finance has such a hand to play. So it's not all government sector. It has to be the private sector. It's banking, it's finance, it's investors, it's impact investors, it's philanthropy, because we can provide for our own. We just need the investments to make that happen. Some of that can come from government, but it's incumbent upon the public sector to have their lenders and financiers do their jobs, come into the community, see all the businesses, for-profit businesses that are doing a great job. And if they have 5 employees, we need them to have the working capital so they can have 25 employees, and so on and so on. And it's just math. And I think it's also basic. So if we can sort of unclog all of the statistics and just get down to the brass tacks and fund Black businesses.
I appreciate you chiming in, and we'd like to hear from other caller 202-588-0893, 202-588-0893. I'm speaking with Connor Zielinski, a data associate at the DC Fiscal Policy Institute. Connor, your thoughts on the input from our caller.
Yeah, Gloria, thank you so much for calling in, and thank you for all the wonderful work you're doing. intentional policies got us into this situation of purposeful disinvestment, redlining. Historical and ongoing systemic racism has brought us to this, but that also means intentional policies can get us out in a deliberate effort into supporting our most vulnerable populations in the district would be phenomenal. In particular, DC should expand the child tax credit to those above 6 and under 17 and increase the tax, the minimum credit to at least $1,500 per child for the families with the lowest incomes. $1,500 per child would cover nearly 3 months of groceries and 2 months of rent for a single parent and two kids while reducing poverty. And that is something that that lawmakers should definitely consider on top of engaging in grassroots organizing and working with communities and making sure that everyone is able to access the resources they need in order to thrive.
I mean, it's just extraordinarily important. We want to hear from callers. We have a few minutes left. 202-588-0893. This is tax season, folks. And we need to hear from you. It's terribly important that our listeners understand that our input is needed right now in terms of how children, the most vulnerable amongst us, are supported, particularly those children that are east of the river. 202-588-0893. We want to hear from you. I'm speaking with Connor Zielinski. He's the data associates at the DC Fiscal Policy Institute, just doing tremendous work. We had them on last week. We're having them on this week. I mean, they are at the core of understanding of what's happening here in our district. Before we move on to our next guest, Connor, any other observations about what you think needs to be done in terms of policy here in the district?
Yeah, the district has the opportunity to raise revenues at a time where our revenues are unfortunately not necessarily under our control due to meddling in Congress, and raising revenue through a tax on the most high-income early earners in the district would be beneficial for, again, supporting all the programs that so many people rely on.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it sounds like we're doing the numbers. It sounds like we're off in the statistics, but we're talking about our children here. We're talking about our future here in the district. It's terribly important that people understand that the policies that the district is carrying out and that the federal government are carrying out really have impact here in the district. If I can ask you to speculate, I mean, what are we facing in terms of the Trump administration, Connor, in terms of the impact on the people in the district? This is clearly an administration that is not holding in high regard the concerns of people that are disadvantaged. What do you see happening here in the district and nationwide?
Yeah, federal lawmakers are poised to cut the benefits that we care about most, including SNAP, Social Security. And unfortunately, that is something that the district government would also be subject to if the that CR
were. Let me turn off the blur.
That would be something that the district government would have to remedy through tax increases to recover all that lost tax revenue.
Yeah, I mean, it's rather daunting. I mean, we're right on the cusp today of, you know, a potential $1 billion cut in funding of monies that our district taxpayers have already paid in. We're not talking about federal monies flowing to the district. We're talking about $1 billion that we in the district have already contributed to our tax base, and Trump et al. Is talking about cutting that. If you could talk about, if you can, what that would mean in terms of support for disadvantaged people in the district.
Yeah, and on top of us losing that $1.1 billion of our hard-earned tax income, the Trump administration and its furloughing of so many people, hardworking D.C. residents, has drastically reduced our upcoming revenue forecast. And that would, again, make it harder to pay for these programs. So really, again, just to reiterate, the D.C. should seek to increase revenue on those who make the most.
I mean, it's rather extraordinary. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, the Trump administration cutting off federal funding to the district. We're talking about monies that we ourselves have raised in the district and the federal government, because we are not a state, is playing around with our own budget. I mean, it's rather extraordinary.
It is. It's an unprecedented meddling in our affairs. And again, it threatens a whole lot in the district.
Yeah, I mean, it's an extraordinary state of affairs. I remember moving here in the early 90s and going, my goodness, I don't actually have a representation in this Congress. I mean, it's something that our listeners have heard for decades, but, you know, it's still rather extraordinary. You know, we contribute in terms of our tax dollar to the federal budget. We contribute in terms of providing our young men and women for military service, and yet we don't have actual representation. I mean, it comes back to haunt us continually.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's why DC FBI also advocates for DC statehood.
I mean, and it seems like an avocation that is getting further and further away from us. I mean, we talk about it all the time, but in fact, you know, particularly given the consolation of what's going on in the Congress, we in fact are further away from it. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, all I can say is that, you know, we continue to push for the things we believe in, like DC FBI's vision that every DC resident has everything that they need to live to their fullest. And we do that by seeking an equitable system that works for everyone. And we keep pushing for that.
Yeah. We're going to end it there. I've been speaking with Connor Zielinski. He's a data associate at the DC Fiscal Policy Institute. Thank you for all you're doing, and thank you for joining us today.
Really, yes, thank you so much for having me. Thank you for
having me. It's great having you. And on to our next guest. So the DC Environmental Film Festival is running now through March 29th. We're joined now by the producer writers of one of the festival films, Waiting for Amani. Peter Argueta, welcome to Community Watch and Comment. It's great to have you.
Great to be here, David. Thanks.
And I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly.
Yeah, you nailed it. Peter Getz. And the film's called Searching for Amani.
And tell us about this film. I think, you know, I keep being reminded by maybe the only cogent thing that Joseph Stalin said, which is, you know, that numbers can be numbing, but a story is is a tragedy. And if you could talk about the tragedies that are included in the documentary that you're involved with.
Yeah, Searching for Imani is a coming-of-age story on a frontline community in northern Kenya. The film takes place in Laikipia County, and it's essentially a young boy I met 2 months after his father was unfortunately murdered on the largest nature conservancy in northern Kenya that was dealing with one of the worst droughts in their history. His father was a peacekeeper and the lead tour guide at the largest nature conservancy in Laikipia County. And so the family really didn't have that many answers of what had happened to their father and husband. So we were looking for a coming of age story in a climate frontline community. And Simon Ali's story was really something that was extremely touching and tragic. Yet there is a silver lining to the film itself, where they unpack the circumstances of this murder and are basically looking to build bridges within their community, trying to bring peace and figure out ways of, you know, overcoming this very difficult situation out there in Kenya.
I mean, it's a coming of age story. I mean, of a 13-year-old who becomes an aspiring journalist, and he's put in the context of a global situation where he becomes, through trying to understand the murder of his father, becomes aware of the existential issues that involve with the global warming throughout the world. If you could talk about that. I mean, it's an extraordinary story. And I should say, I haven't seen the film yet. I intend to. But I mean, it's an important and worldwide relevant story for all of us to hear.
Yeah, well, if you get a chance after work today, David, you can go to the AFI Theater in Silver Spring. Catch the 2:40 p.m. showing, or it's also playing tomorrow at 8:40 in the evening. But it is an extraordinary story. And I actually was just touring around with Simon Ali and his best friend, Haran Langus, through D.C., attending the D.C. Environmental Film Fest and the New African Festival. So, you know, really the film is about those who contribute the least to climate change oftentimes suffer the most. And this film embodies that message. It's, you really fall in love with Simon and his family. You empathize with him, and it's a human story. Oftentimes climate change can be very theoretical, and folks, especially in the West, aren't immediately affected by the fallout of these extreme weather events. Although more and more we're seeing that, like I'm from Los Angeles, California, and just suffered tremendously through the fires. But the story in Africa is just, you know, one story of many of folks that, you know, aren't consuming a lot of energy on a day-to-day basis, but they're feeling the burn of climate change every day.
I mean, it's rather extraordinary, and it's wonderful that you're involved with documentary filmmaking, particularly in this era. I mean, the documentary that won the best documentary, No Other Land, I believe one of the producers just got beaten up and arrested by the Israeli government on the West Bank in Gaza. Hopefully you're not subjected to that, but you folks are on the cutting edge making these documentaries. I mean, how did you get involved in all of this? I mean, you're clearly in it for making a lot of money. Isn't that true, Peter?
Yeah, it's always been about the money and power, David. No, definitely not. I think, you know, it's a tragedy. That's what's happened out there in East Bank. And, you know, as filmmakers, we all have to stick together. And I think there's a lot of noise in the day-to-day headlines that come through, especially in this day and age. So being able to spend 5 years dedicating our passions to a story and then bringing it to audiences around the globe, it's a responsibility and it's an honor. And I'm about to head out tomorrow to the Human Rights Film Festival out in Zurich. And I got into it, you know, early on in my career. I actually randomly started more mainstream television on Survivor, that TV show, and then quickly found out that I was definitely more interested in human stories, not large formatted television shows. And it's been 20 years since that first run on that television show, and really honing in on creating impact films, purpose-driven films. I've had my production company, Backroads Pictures, for the last 10 years, and we focused primarily on conservation, climate, and social justice films. So this is something that is my life's passion, and there's a community of filmmakers and storytellers in the world that you know, are all here to try to highlight and give microphones to voices often not heard. So Searching for Imani is it's been a 5-year endeavor for us. We premiered at Tribeca and won Best New Director. My partner on the film, Nicole Gormley, and our Kenyan partner, Deborah Oroko, did an amazing job sculpting this film and honing in on the story. It's a very complex story that we were able to unpack in 80 minutes and give our audiences an opportunity to fall in love with this one boy and his plight and his family story living in the north of Kenya. So it's an honor.
It's an honor to have you with us, and I so appreciate, and I think our listeners would agree with me, so support the work that you're doing. Many thanks for all of us. I've been speaking with Peter Goetz, producer and writer for the film Waiting for Imani. Thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, David. Yeah, and so everybody, please catch Searching for Imani at the AFI Theater in Silver Spring today and tomorrow. I'd love to have you. And follow us on Instagram, Searching for Imani, and Backroads Pictures. It's been a pleasure, David. Have a good one.
Really appreciate it. And on to our final guest, there's another film showing at the DC Environmental Film Festival, Upstream, Downriver, Uniting for Water Justice. The film takes viewers into the heart of the battle for water justice. Stories from frontline community activists are interwoven with historical context about landmark regulations that significantly reduced water pollution in the United States, that failed to serve disadvantaged communities that are hardest hit by today's climate crisis, which we are very much are in. We're joined now by the director and producer of Upstream, Downriver, Uniting for Water Justice, Maggie Stogner. I believe we're also joined by Catherine Coleman Flowers, who's featured in the film. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, David. It's good to be here.
Thank you.
Great having you. Catherine Flower, talk about your work, if you would.
Well, my work started in Lowndes County, Alabama, which is located between Selma and Montgomery. And it started around the sanitation issue, where people are, when they flush their toilets, it goes out onto the ground. Or if they have a failing septic system, it comes back into the home. And initially, when I got started back in 2002, the state of Alabama was arresting poor people in Lowndes County who could not afford sanitation. And we partnered with some folk, some people that are still here in DC. We partnered with them to fight to end the arrest. But what we have since found is that the sanitation issue is a nationwide issue. that is not just in rural communities, but it's largely in rural communities because it's unseen, but also because of climate change, the big pipe systems are failing too. And we can't talk about water without talking about sanitation. So a lot of my work has been around that. And I also have a book that's out now that talks about my work and talks about its connection to the earth, how we're all connected together, the interdependence of Mother Nature and our existence in a way in which now I think it's been discouraged from us to talk about. But the book talks about that, and it's entitled Holy Ground.
It's just so important. Maggie Stockner, what inspired you to make this documentary, Upstream Downriver, Uniting for Water Justice? What are you hoping to inspire, if you will, in terms of the greater environmental movement?
Yeah, thanks for asking and thanks for inviting us. So we did a shorter film for the 50-year anniversary of the Clean Water Act. And then we got some funding to expand it out to a larger film. And most of the stories in the film, like Catherine's story, are lesser known stories about water justice, about water equity. So one goal was to just raise awareness about these different facets. For instance, one story we have, additional story we have, is with Dr. Crystal Tully Cordova on the Navajo Nation. She's a principal hydrologist, where over 30% of the people on the Navajo Nation do not have running water, do not have sanitation infrastructure. 30% in this country, you know, and Catherine talks about how 2.2 million people in this country do not have sanitation infrastructure in this country. You know, these are stories that are not well known by a lot of people. So part of it was to raise awareness, and the other part is just to get involved, because they all of the people that we feature in the film are community leaders. They're getting people engaged, getting the community engaged and coming together to fight for this justice.
Yeah, I mean it's so important. I mean, you can go and see this film, but more importantly, you can become more aware of water issues around here in the district and across the country. It's terribly, terribly important. Maggie Stockner, how did you get alerted to this issue? How did you get involved and motivated to make this film, which is a big project? It's not just you operating as an individual. You know, it's an enormous project to actually put together a film such as you have created here.
Yeah, no, it takes a village. My own water passion starts young. I'm from the San Francisco area. There was a horrific oil spill when I was a kid, and I just can't even, you know, that memory is imprinted in me so strongly.
Are we talking about the Santa Barbara oil spill?
No, the one in the San Francisco Bay Area where two oil tankers collided in 1971. And wow. I think it wiped out the bird population. It was awful. I mean, you know, but you look at water issues all around the country. And I ended up I run the Center for Environmental Filmmaking at American University, and I partnered with American University's Center for Environmental Policy. We did a film about the Clean Air Act, and then this one about the Clean Water Act. But in order to take those policies and help people connect with what, you know, how important they are, and like the Clean Water Act, how important it is to at least try to make sure that there's clean water for everybody. How do you do that? You do that through personal stories. And so a lot of people got involved, and my students and alum, but also just, you know, even the people that participate in the film through their organizations, through other water organizations, American Rivers, the Waterkeeper Alliance, River Network, you know, there's the Clean Water for All collective, you know, there's lots of people trying to come together to make sure that we can make some progress on there being clean water for everybody and the kind of infrastructure we need to to ensure that. It's not, you know, it's a constant battle. It's not like you can just do it and it's done and, oh, okay, tie it up with a big red bow. It's a constant battle. We have to be on it all the time. So I'm thrilled to be able to continue to expand this project. We're calling it the Upstream Downriver Water Justice Media Project. We'll be embarking on a series of short profiles of women water leaders in this space as well. If people are interested, you can go just to upstreamdownriver.org and find out more about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's you're going to have some national airings of this, even if you can't get to the festival. I think if you could talk about that, there's going to be opportunities for people to see this documentary nationally.
Yeah. I mean, we're with DC Environmental Film Festival, great festival, by the way. And that's tonight. Our longer film is premiering tonight at American University. But we've also been selected by American Public Television, which is a distribution branch for public television. So it will be at stations across the country beginning in April. Maryland Public Television is our presenting station. But if you're not seeing it on your station lists, make sure you reach out to your public television stations and say, hey, we need to see this film, you know, Upstream, Downriver, Uniting for Water Justice. We want to see it. It's a great way for people to come together and further the work. You know, the film's just a starting point. We hope that it really inspires and motivates audiences to take that baton and carry it forward.
I mean, it's wonderful that you have this, the kind of distribution that you have, which is not apparently been offered to the winner of the best documentary at the Academy Awards, No Other Land. I mean, they don't, I believe, unless it happened yesterday or today, they do not have a national distributor in the United States of this film. It won the best documentary at the Oscars, and it doesn't have a national distributor here in the United States. It does have distribution elsewhere in the world, but not here in the U.S. I mean, any thoughts about that? I mean, it's rather extraordinary to me.
Yeah, David, you know, well, this is a big conversation, particularly in the D.C. area. I mean, the media industry has just imploded. But I really look at that and I think, you know, okay, there's distribution that the traditional distribution models, but there's also, and you know, Catherine and I have talked about this, and you know, if there are models to be able to look at how can your film have impact and where can you have the most impact and who can you influence that will make the change that needs to be made. And that's another path, another framework for films to make a significant difference. So it's not just necessarily being on television or, you know, on Netflix or whatever, it's actually really building those communities and those kind of concentric circles that get wider and wider and wider and having real impact that way. And I don't know, Catherine, you probably have a lot to offer on that as well.
Well, I think that, you know, we have other platforms to get it out too. And we're exploring and partnering with young people. We now have a media fellow out with. This is Enterprise in Environmental Justice, and working with him and working with, we even signed, for an example, the first NIL contracts with an HBCU with female basketball players so that they can promote the work we're doing around climate change. They have a following. That. I mean, we have to be more, we have to become more creative. Mm-hmm. It's almost like, you know, back during slavery, you know, have an underground way of getting the word out to people as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's extraordinary that there's incredible work being done out there in the documentary film arena, and people are having difficulty accessing it. We're going to have to end it there. I've been speaking with Maggie Stogner, Catherine Flowers, about their documentary Upstream, Downriver, Uniting for Water Justice. Thank you so much for all you're doing, and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, David. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Really appreciate it. That's going to do it for today's show. Thanks to Mike Nocella for his engineering expertise. And coming up, the WPFW news headlines, followed by Don't Forget the Blues with the wonderful Lady Murr. Love to hear your comments, your questions, your thoughts, your input. drabin902@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Dave Rabin. Stay safe. Stay safe. I can't even speak anymore. Stay safe and have a good week. Take care. Thank you for listening.
African filmmaking from all corners of the continent and across the diaspora is featured at the 21st New African Film Festival, presented by AFI and Africa World Now Project at AFI Silver Theater and Culture Center in downtown Silver Spring from March 14 to the 27th. The festival features 29 films from 19 countries, discussions with filmmakers, and more. The 2025 New African Film Festival features the diversity of new filmmaking from Africa. Tickets and full schedule at afi.com/silver. That's afi.com/silver or at 301-495-6700. That's 301-495-6700. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Education, art, health, music, politics, and all things community.
Yes!
Join me, Ambrose Lane Jr., as we uncover the issues of D.C. communities east of the river on To the East, Mondays at 5 p.m. right here on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW 89.3 FM.
Hey, this is Alvin Nedab, your host of Music Memories, and my co-host,
Deborah Nedab.
And guess what, Deborah?
What?
We're moving.
We're moving?
That's right. We're moving from Mondays, 2 a.m. to 5 a.m., till Saturdays, 2 a.m. to 5 a.m., starting next Saturday, March 22nd. And Deborah, guess what?
What?
We're going to still continue to play the best old school music of all time. So we just want you to be there. 89.3.
Get WPFW swag in your life? Items that say, I support Jazz and Justice without saying a word. We've got you covered. Details and browsing at WPFWFM.org. Again, that's WPFWFM.org.
Jazz lovers, the 15th annual Washington Women in Jazz Festival is back with a weekend of performances, workshops, and jam sessions at the Penn Arts Mansion in Washington, D.C. on March 29th and 30th. From interactive workshops to concerts and late-night jams, there's something for everyone. Details at WashingtonWomenInJazz.com. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hello, WPFW. Festival season is here. You know what that means. Good events, good music, good food, good people, good weather, and the 9th annual Words, Beats, and Life Festival happening April 3rd through the 6th all over Washington, D.C. There will be DJs, concerts, poetry slams, children's activities, and a festival. Details can be found at wblinc.org/WBLFest.
Greetings. WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. Benefits of your membership are at WPFWFM.org under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at WPFWFM.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world,
one broadcast at a time.
I'm Candy Shannon, and you are tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.